From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. The latest addition to the literature of combat is a new memoir about the first Gulf War. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Anthony Swafford, author of the critically acclaimed book Jarhead. Swafford was a Marine sniper on the front line. Also, Russian polkas and Argentinian tangos are just part of the repertoire of violinist Gidon Kremer. He started playing the violin at 4 years of age and attended the Moscow Conservatory. His new CD, Happy Birthday, celebrates the fifth birthday of his chamber orchestra, Kremerata Baltica. We'll meet Gidon Kremer. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration believes it's making progress in persuading a reluctant UN Security Council to pass a new resolution on Iraq and set the stage for military action. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Secretary of State Colin Powell told several European reporters he would decide next week whether to push for a vote on a resolution that says Iraq has failed to take its last opportunity to disarm peacefully. The U.S. needs 9 of the 15 council members to back the resolution and no vetoes from permanent members. Only 3 other council members publicly support the U.S. position, though one State Department official insisted the U.S. lobbying effort is making progress and suggested a vote is likely. Still, the U.S. has what one senior State Department official described as a straight-up disagreement with France, which along with other council members wants more time for inspections. France and Germany are both sending their foreign ministers to the UN Friday to hear the latest report by top weapons inspectors. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
President Bush is proposing a plan that would allow private health networks to compete in the Medicare system. The president told an audience of doctors at the American Medical Association convention that his plan would give senior citizens more choices and better treatment, but critics charge that the plan would dismantle Medicare. Mr. Bush said his plan would subsidize prescription drug costs for Medicare recipients who switch to private health plans and HMOs. Senator Ted Kennedy, a Massachusetts Democrat, condemned the plan, saying it would force elderly patients to give up the doctors they trust to get the medicine they need. The American who was killed by a bomb in an airport in the Philippines was a Southern Baptist missionary. The State Department says 27 people died and nearly 150 were injured, including another Southern Baptist missionary and her 2 children. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
William Hyde went to the airport on Mindanao Island to greet some arriving colleagues when a backpack containing a bomb exploded. Hyde was the latest American missionary to die violently. On December 30th, 3 Southern Baptist missionaries were gunned down in Yemen by Muslim extremists, and before that, missionaries have been attacked in Lebanon and India. Some believe the violence reflects anti-American sentiment by Muslims as troops prepare to invade Iraq. Some missionaries worry that their own denomination is making things worse. Top officials in the Southern Baptist Convention have openly supported war in Iraq, and after the Yemen attack, missionaries in the Muslim world asked the officials to tone down their remarks. No one has suggested that the Mindanao attack was aimed at Christians specifically. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 133 points, or 1.7%, to close at 7,704 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 12 points. This is NPR News. A federal appeals court in California has suspended enforcement of its ruling that it's unconstitutional for children to recite the Pledge of Allegiance in public schools as long as it includes the words "under God." The stay will give a California school district 90 days to take the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. If the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had not stayed its decision, it would have prevented millions of school children in 9 states from reciting the pledge as of Monday morning. Mardi Gras is in full swing in New Orleans with carnival costumes, parades, and make-believe royalty. Susan Rosgen is there.
In spite of overcast skies and what seems like a smaller crowd than usual, the king of carnival would not disappoint his royal subjects. His Majesty this year is Richard Freeman, a former Coca-Cola bottling executive, chosen to reign over Mardi Gras. Following tradition, Carnival's signature parade of brightly colored floats rolls down St. Charles Avenue to the edge of the historic French Quarter. There, thousands of people, mostly tourists, will party into the night, doing things they'll probably regret tomorrow. But it all ends at midnight when police officers on horseback sweep through the streets, clearing the way for the parade of garbage trucks. For NPR News, I'm Susan Rosgen in New Orleans.
The new board that was created to regulate the accounting industry has voted to require that all accounting firms working in the United States must register with it. The rule would require foreign accounting firms to register with the board, despite strenuous objections from the European Union. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR online shop features a variety of merchandise, including the new series of music compilations, I Heard It on NPR. On the NPR website, npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. In August 1990, Anthony Swofford was deployed to Saudi Arabia as a lance corporal in a U.S. Marine Corps sniper platoon. He just turned 20. In his new memoir, Jarhead, about his experience during the Gulf War, Swofford describes the tedium and the absurdity and the loneliness of waiting in the desert for the ground war to begin. He writes of the relentless sand and heat, of bloodlust and the devastation of war. In a review, Mark Bowden called Jarhead a classic that will go down with the best books ever written about military life. He writes, as Swofford moves through a nightmare landscape of exploding ordnance, raining petroleum, the threat of invisible killing gases, and death, his terror and his joy are one. Swofford's fiction and nonfiction has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, and the Iowa Review. Jarhead is his first book. We begin with a reading. In this passage, Swofford comes upon a group of dead Iraqi soldiers, still arranged in a circle around a campfire, where they had been surprised by American bombs.
6 tin coffee cups sit among the remains of the fire. The men's boots are cooked to their feet. The man to my right has no head. To my left, the man's head is between his legs, and his arms hang at his sides like the burnt flags of defeated countries. The insects of the dead are swarming. Though I can make out no insignia, I imagine that the man across from me commanded the unit, and that when the bombs landed, he was in the middle of issuing a patrol order. Tomorrow we will kick some American ass. It would be silly to speak, but I'd like to. I want to ask the dead men their names and identification numbers and tell them this will soon end. They must have questions for me, but the distance between the living and the dead is too immense to breach. I could bend at the waist, close my eyes, and try to join these men in their tight, dead circle. But I am not yet one of them. I must not close my eyes.
What made you go down there and sit with those corpses?
Fascination, wanting to become closer, more intimate with the devastation. Perhaps a hope that moving into that tight, dead circle that I would kind of find some distance between me and my own possible death that was forthcoming maybe to the north, which is where we were heading to fight.
Were you told anything about how to prepare for combat or possible death? For instance, I don't know, to clean up your stuff in case you're killed and there might be something among your effects that would be embarrassing to your family.
It was probably a few days before ground combat began, and a few days prior to that, my platoon started running missions across the border. There was a big berm that had been built between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, and we were right up at the berm for a few days and running missions across in the evening. But our staff sergeant directed us to get rid of, any Marine letters that weren't from your girlfriend or your wife or pornography. It was anything that your wife or your girlfriend or your mother would rather not see. There was word that a few guys who died in a friendly fire incident, an A-10 had dropped rather devastating bomb on a troop carrier. And there was word that among the effects of one of these guys who was married, there were, oh, I don't know, half a dozen photos and letters from various people that, you know, may have been nothing serious and simply a way of finding solace over there for him. But, yeah, the word was get that stuff out of your ruck, out of your sea bag, bury it, burn it, get rid of it.
When you did first engage the enemy in combat, what happened?
Well, the first time we were in sort of a high spot in the desert, and our communication shop was setting up in an area where they would get the best reception, but where it also made us visible to an enemy observation post that was across the border and in a bit of a range. And so that first event was artillery rounds that were incoming on our position. We were just beginning to dig in around the battalion command post when the rounds came in. And, I didn't believe that they were artillery rounds exploding in front of me.
When the rounds hit the sand, what does it look like?
Well, for me, it looked like a flower blooming or exploding, and there's, you know, the sand is burnt a bit black, and there's a little explosion. So it's the burnt munitions along with the beige of the sand combining and then kind of raining down after the explosion.
Now, after the all clear was called, what did you and the rest of your unit do? Did you set up to attack the enemy position?
Well, we were, as the forward observers for the battalion, that was our mission. And my partner Johnny was the first to gain visual on the enemy observation post. And with his guidance, along with another Marine, I gathered the map location of the enemy position and prepared a call for fire to put into the fire center. I was going to be asking for bombs from a plane, probably a Harrier. But just as I was about to make that call, a captain arrived who thought it best if he called the mission in. And so the handset of the radio was taken from my hands and handed off to this captain, who indeed made the call. And the bombs were impacting shortly thereafter on this enemy position across the way.
During your time in the Gulf War, did you train your sniper's rifle at a living being, and did you fire?
I did train my rifle on a few living beings. I never did fire. Johnny and I were deployed with another battalion that was fighting at the Al Jabar airfield in southern Kuwait. And there were enemy officers in the control tower, air control tower on the airfield, and all the glass was shot out, and they were rather prime targets. We asked to take shots, asked for permission. We were in our position and prepared to shoot, but we were asked to hold off. And then later in the day, as the infantry did their work on the airfield, a group of Iraqis, probably a little less than a platoon, they were attempting to surrender, but there was no one near to surrender to. They had their boots off and strung around their necks and were waving T-shirts or underwear, whatever kind of white material they'd found. And eventually they just sat down and began eating their rations, and I guess they assumed that someone would come along that they could surrender to. And I was somewhat frustrated with those men, and because, you know, I obviously couldn't shoot them, but I popped around from head to head, pretending that I might have.
You did that in your mind's eye, you mean?
I did that with my rifle, with my scope.
And then you took them prisoner, or what happened then?
Someone else took them prisoner.
How did you find out the war was over?
Well, in a rather peculiar way, my partner Johnny and I had been on a mission. And over the course of the mission, which was about a day, we'd seen a lot of retreating Iraqi vehicles. And over the radio frequencies, we heard of an occasional fight, an occasional skirmish with troops. But we weren't picked up the next morning when we were supposed to be, which caused us a bit of concern. And we decided to hike our way back to what we knew was supposed to be the last position of our unit. And as we made the rise that was just our side of the flat where our unit was supposed to be, we heard music and we were kind of concerned. We thought it was a trick. We didn't know really what was happening because the war was still on. And we slowly climbed up this rise, our bellies in the sand, and on the other side of it, there was men from our battalion with their shirts off playing football. Jimi Hendrix, I think, was piping through the comm towers. The first sergeant who'd played the game with the kazoo was handing out cigars, and everyone was happy because the war was over. And that's how Johnny and I found out that things had ended.
No, after the war was declared over, you took part in the cleanup operation, and you went through Iraqi bunkers, and you write that you all gleefully ran through the enemy positions and noting the hundreds of different ways a man might die when 500-pound bombs are dropped on a weakly fortified position. And a Marine in your battalion became obsessed with one of the Iraqi corpses. What was the nature of his obsession?
For this Marine, I think the corpse both signified hope because he was alive and also maybe despair because the war had ended and he'd been looking for more of a fight, and perhaps he was already having trouble with the issue of having not really been involved in a long war.
What did he do to the corpse?
Well, he desecrated the corpse. He took his e-tool to it, which is a small folding shovel, and he made this corpse his kind of special project and went at it daily until it was buried.
Who buried it?
I did. I was tired of knowing that was happening. It was sickening and troubling. And though this Marine probably went on to another corpse to do the same, and he had his reasons for doing that. They're not probably not acceptable to anyone.
Did you take anything from these Iraqi bunkers with you?
Yeah, I did. I took some dog tags off of a few corpses. Their dog tags were rather crude things, whereas in the U.S. we use a press, and their dog tags are just on thin sheets of metal, and the information is scrawled in with an awl. And I still have those dog tags.
Yeah, there's a lot of mythology about dog tags. I think you write in the book that people would order tons of them to surround themselves with as many pairs as possible, so as if that would be a talisman against death.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that your mother has a pair and your little brother and your girlfriend, and you nail them to the wall in some bar in the Philippines, and you've spread yourself so far and wide that there's no way you can die because your dog tags are out there kind of pulsing in the around the globe.
Anthony Swofford's new memoir is Jarhead. Coming up, we remember singer and songwriter Hank Ballard. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Chubby Checker had the hit, but it was Hank Ballard who wrote and first recorded The Twist, which inspired the 1960s dance craze. Hank Ballard died this past Sunday after suffering from throat cancer. Ballard was the lead singer for the Royals, later known as the Midnighters. His recording, Work With Me, Annie, was the biggest R&B hit of 1954. Terry Gross spoke with Hank Ballard in 1993 from his home in L.A. and asked him to remember the first time he heard Chubby Checker's cover of The Twist. He told Terry he was taking a swim.
And I heard this twist blasting across white radio, pop station down in Miami, the biggest pop station down there. But when the man said Chubby Checker, after the first chorus, I knew it wasn't me. You know, but when the first eight bars, I thought it was me.
So the first time you heard Chubby Checker's recording of The Twist, for the first chorus, you thought it was you. Then you realized it wasn't you. When you listen to those records now, what do you think of the comparison between your version and the cover?
I know my version is superior to Chubby Checker's. If you put the two on, you can see the difference. My version has more guts in it, more drive, and my vocal is a little superior over Chubby Checker. When I hear some of these reporters, when I see, sometimes they write that Chubby Checker had a slicker version. What was slick about his version? I don't know. The slickness came when American Bandstand was playing it. Dick Clark, that's what made The Twist. You could have recorded The Twist and it would have been a hit if Dick Clark was playing it.
You think so?
Yeah, but man, during that time, you could record a grunt. If Dick Clark played it, it was a hit overnight.
No, how come Dick Clark played Chubby Checker's version of The Twist and not yours?
Chubby Checker was in Dick Clark's stable. You know, he had a stable of artists. That was Frankie Avalon, Bobby Rydell, Dee Dee Shark, Fabian. Now, all these acts was in his stable.
And Chubby Checker was one of the guys from Philadelphia where Bandstand came out
of. Yeah, but see, he was also... Okay, I'll give you a good hint. Dick Clark's wife is the one that named him Chubby Checker. Doesn't that tell you something?
Right, so he was in on the record.
It was a lot of politics going on during that time with this particular record, between Dick Clark and my record company. Uh-huh. Dick Clark made Finger Poppin' Time a hit. You know, my A&R man told me that Dick Clark made a deal with King Records, that if they didn't release my version of The Twist, he would make Finger Poppin' Time a hit for me, which he did.
So do you think most people realize now that you wrote The Twist and recorded
it
first?
No, they associate The Twist with Chubby Checker.
Mm-hmm. So have you spent much time with Chubby Checker?
Oh, yeah. You know what? See, Chubby has a terrible ego. See, but I've been nice to Chubby down through the years, been nice to him and his wife. I'm a thorn in his side. I'm like a nuisance, you know? He cannot go down in history without dragging me with him. And he hates that.
Can we go back to the mid-50s and talk about some of your hits from then?
Yeah.
There was your song, Work With Me, Annie.
You weren't even born then.
Oh, yes, I was.
That was in 1954.
I was born.
Huh?
Yeah. Now, there were a lot of stations that banned that record from
They banned it and made it the biggest, it's the fifth biggest R&B record ever recorded.
What were the lyrics and why was it banned?
It was banned because I had suggestive lyrics. You know, like when I first wrote the song, I had a different title. I had Sock It To Me, Annie. But FCC, the Sock It To Me is a no-no. It's obscene. So I changed it to Roll With Me, Annie. They said Roll With Me is obscene. You can't use that lyric. So what I did, now during that time, that was a time in the ghetto in Detroit, they had a... They had this little slang going around. Say, man, did you get some work last night? You're talking about sex, you know. Did you get some work last night? So I know what I'll do. I'll call it Work With Me, Annie, you know? Then they won't know what I'm talking about. They can read between the lines. But what made it so obvious when the lyric, Annie, please don't cheat, give me all my meat. That's when the suggestive lyrics came in.
Well, did you think of The Twist and Finger Poppin' Time as suggestive?
No, but the FCC tried to say that The Twist was obscene. But there's nothing obscene about The Twist and Finger Poppin' Time. I wrote Finger Poppin' Time. I was in a restaurant on Broadway there in New York. And it was a gentleman sitting next to me. And this young lady walked up and said, Mister, can you tell me what time it is? He popped his finger and said, baby, it's Finger Poppin' Time. So that sounds like a good song title, you know? I went to the hotel, wrote that one in about 15 minutes.
Listen, for any of our listeners who don't remember that song, would you just sing a couple of lines of it?
What, Finger Poppin' Time?
Yeah.
Hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now, it's finger pop, popping time. Finger popping, popping time. I feel so good, and that's a real good sign.
Yes, I do feel good. I'm airborne, folks. No. You know what? I know with soul finger popping time, it has country overtones. The melody is country.
You think so?
Yeah, because my first music was country. I still like country music.
Huh?
Yeah, the whole melody, finger popping time, and my rhythm is country. On almost all my songs, my rhythm is my guitar doing country licks.
Well, that's interesting.
Well, yeah, if you listen, you'll hear. That's why nobody can play the twist the way my band does it, because most guitars don't play that country lick, you know, especially the black guitars. It's that country lick that makes my rhythm.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
You know, it's been nice talking to you, you know?
Terry Gross spoke with Hank Ballard in 1993. Hank Ballard died this past Sunday. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Hey, now, hey, now.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of The Cave, an allegorical novel by Jose Saramago, author of Blindness. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet violinist Gidon Kremer. He leads the orchestra Kremeralta Baltica, a group of musicians from the Baltic states. Their new CD, Happy Birthday, celebrates their fifth birthday. Kremer is currently on a U.S. tour. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The next time it's your birthday, instead of listening to friends sing to you off-key, you could play one of the variations of Happy Birthday from the new album by my guest, Gidon Kremer, and his Kremeralta Baltica Orchestra. And that's Happy Birthday in the style of Dvorak. Gidon Kremer is an internationally renowned violinist. This is how Yo-Yo Ma describes Kremer's playing. It's as if he's creating the music at that moment, that he's organically part of the composer's mind, and the notes are passing through him. Kramer is also known as a musician who takes risks. Throughout his career in post-Stalinist Russia, he championed contemporary composers who were out of favor with the Soviet leadership. After emigrating to the West, Kramer became enthralled with the music of Astor Piazzolla before the tango was widely accepted in the classical repertoire. In 1996, he founded the Kramerata Baltica, a chamber orchestra made up of young musicians from three Baltic states, Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. Let's hear some more Happy Birthday variations from their new CD. I asked Gidon Kramer how he put the chamber orchestra together.
It was just a couple of weeks before I celebrated my 50th birthday, and I had this idea to give myself a present by organizing an orchestra, but I intended to assemble the musicians only for a summertime for the 1997 festival in Lockenhaus, a festival which I do run now already for 22 years. So around my 50th birthday, I wanted to assemble musicians from the countries I was in my youth the closest to, since I am a native of Latvia. But once I got to know these people, once I started to work with them, it became evident to me that I can't part from them, and I just want to maintain this wonderful atmosphere of cooperating with these musicians.
Now, you were born in 1947 in Riga, Latvia, and your parents were both violinists. Also your grandfather, right?
That's correct.
Did they all play in the state orchestra?
My grandfather was a professor at the Academy of Music in Riga, and both my parents played in a national radio orchestra. My mother worked there for 27 years as a violinist.
And your mother spoke German, your grandfather was Swedish, and your father was a Baltic Jew. So
exactly.
It's really a very mixed ethnicity. Did you fit in?
Yeah, recently I had to think about my father because seeing the movie The Pianist by Roman Polanski, such a strong and striking movie which impressed me a lot, as probably everyone that is going to see it. I had to think about my father because, in fact, the story, the plot of the movie is exactly the story of my father, who escaped and survived the ghetto in Riga, where 35 relatives of his were killed, including his wife and his little daughter.
How did he survive? People hid him? He hid in apartments? He hid in... In
cellars? Yeah, he hid in cellars in an apartment which a Latvian lady, not an apartment, but in a little back room of an apartment which a Latvian lady gave him to hide in cellars. But he did hide for 2 years, and I think now I can much better understand what it meant to him.
So how early did they begin to groom you as a part of the family violin dynasty?
In fact, I started to play violin when I was 4.5 years old, and I'm still playing it.
That sounds as if there must have been a lot of pressures, a lot of dreams that your parents had that they invested in you.
For sure. I even wrote in my book called Splinters of Childhood, I wrote about the pressures of my encounters with my father, for whom I became his second life, because after so after such a tragedy that happened to him, he still had the ambition and the patience to make his son a musician.
You studied at the Moscow Conservatory, and this is in the 60s and the 70s. That's post-Stalinist Soviet Union, and it was really very bleak times economically and politically. What were your circumstances as a music student? What was that time like for you?
It's very difficult for me to answer it in few words, but it was a tough time in Moscow. You had to be very careful what you play, what you say, with whom you associate, who are your friends. And I rather early understood that I can't give in to all the expectations of a governmental system, that I want to live my own life and I want to choose myself what to do, what to play, with whom to be friends. And so pretty easy and pretty soon I got into conflicts with the state system.
Can you give me an example?
As a result of these conflicts, I didn't belong for many years to those artists who were sent as representatives of the country, as representatives of the Soviet Union abroad. Even more, I was literally stopped from traveling for many years abroad. I was not allowed to go to foreign countries, except in the very beginning when I succeeded to win certain competitions. But after I won my main competition and a very recognized competition, the Tchaikovsky competition, 1970, after that, for a number of years, I was not allowed to travel at all, except within the Soviet Union itself.
What then did music mean for you during that time? Was it a safe place to express yourself and your individuality or the tensions that you were suffering from? Or did you always feel that music was subjected to these political and these conformist pressures and that there was tension there also?
I always felt like the music was subjected to these tensions and to this pressure, but at the same time, I did fight for my own freedom, and I still, already at that time when I was not allowed to travel, enlarged immensely my repertoire and got associated with people that I valued a lot, like Alfred Schnittke, Arvo Pärt, Sofia Gubaidulina, Edison Denisov, all those composers who did work, live under the same pressure as all of us.
Violinist Gidon Kremer. Kremer is currently performing on a U.S. tour with Canadian pianist Nada Cole. We'll continue our conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back with violinist Gidon Kremer. He's known as the founder of Kremerata Baltica, a chamber orchestra made up of musicians from the Baltic states. Their new CD is called Happy Birthday. Throughout your career, you've championed the music of Alfred Schnittke, and he was not considered acceptable in the time that you were playing him in the Soviet Union. Can you tell us about him and what drew you to his music?
I was lucky to be befriended with Alfred Schnittke. He was my friend for almost 30 years. Unfortunately, he passed away now already 5 years ago. One should not forget that the 70s were not the same time as the 30s or the 50s in the Soviet Union. Nobody was killed or put into a labor camp for not conforming to the regime, not writing political music, music of socialist realism as the regime maybe wanted. But still, hindrances for performances existed, and most of the composers like Alfred Schnittke, Sofia Gubaidulina, Edison Denisov, Valentin Silvestrov were not subject to many performances of their work would sound here and there on occasion.
Well, what was Schnicka's life like then in the Soviet Union? Did he earn a wage with his composing?
Luckily, as in many countries, and I guess in the United States as well, the cinema helped a lot. You must know how many composers in the 30s emigrated, went to L.A. and worked for the film industry. So many gifted composers among them, like Bernard Herrmann or Miklos Rocha, just naming a couple of them. The same thing happened somehow as well in Russia or in Soviet Union. Composers like Denisov, Alfred Schnittke, Sofia Gubaidulina earned their living by writing film music or occasionally music for theater. But the real compositions they very often had to keep in their tables.
Well, you have a polka from Alfred Schnittke on your new album, Happy Birthday, with the Kremerata Baltica Orchestra. Let's listen to it. Polka from Alfred Schnittke, performed by my guest Gidon Kremer and his orchestra, Kremerata Baltica, from their new CD, Happy Birthday. You left the Soviet Union eventually in 1980. What kind of break was that? Was that a gradual or a dramatic one for you?
Any break, even a very soft one, was a dramatic one at that time. In fact, I did stay abroad during one of the tours, this particular tour when I brought Alfred to the West in 1977, and I demanded at the same time from the authorities to be a free man. I asked them to allow me for 2 years to follow my commitments and concerts in the West. It was a formula which some musicians like Slava Rostropovich used to articulate the no return to the native country. But at the same time, I didn't want to cut my ties with the Soviet Union and with my friends and with my audience. And that's why I enlarged my statement saying, I'd like to stay in the West, but I want to follow up also all my commitments which I have with my concert activities in the Soviet Union. For 2 years, like a miracle, I was allowed to have a passport, which gave me such a privilege among most of the musicians living in Russia at that time. But after 2 years, in 1980, the authorities said, this is enough and you have to return. And then I decided not to return consciously, and I had to face another kind of punishment for about 8 years before the perestroika, in fact, started. I was not anymore considered to be a Soviet artist, to be an artist that can perform in the Soviet Union.
Did you have visiting privileges?
Yeah, I was allowed to visit, and I did visit my daughter who lived in Moscow and my friends during this year, here and there, but just as a tourist. I was never allowed to perform before my return in 1988, when I, for the first time, played again on a stage in Moscow and St. Petersburg, at that time still Leningrad. And this was probably the first case of someone that left the Soviet Union for good, returned. Later, many of the Russian musicians that emigrated returned, but I was probably the only case of a Soviet musician with a Soviet passport that was not allowed to play on the Soviet stage for 8 years and then returned as a Soviet artist living abroad.
Violinist Gidon Kremer. He's currently on a U.S. tour. We'll hear more of our interview after this break. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with Gidon Kremer. He has a new CD of music recorded with his chamber orchestra, Kremerata Baltica. He's currently on a U.S. tour. Another composer that you're known for your interpretations of is Astor Piazzolla, and his tangos you've played long before he became as popular as he is now. You've recorded, what, 6 albums of his music? When did you first hear his work?
Falling in love with Astor Piazzolla was a very unexpected thing for me. I never thought that I would play a tango. Even I knew from my youth already what tango means.
So when you were young, you had heard tangos?
Of course, and I even tried at that time, probably this was the last time, and then I gave up, tried to dance some tangos. But Astor Piazzolla was introduced to me by a friend in Germany on a videotape, and it was striking to see him play, and his music was striking as well. Every time I went to Argentina, I visited many nightclubs, tango clubs, and heard music which was different from all the other. And this was always recognizable, that it was handwriting the tunes of Astor Piazzolla. And so step by step I tried to figure out if there is something for violin and included a couple of encores into my repertoire.
Well, what did you love about it? It's very passionate. It's also very nostalgic music.
What is striking that his music is as sincere, as nostalgic, as dramatic as the music by Franz Schubert. To me, they go kind of together. Even Piazzolla never wrote symphonies and never wrote piano sonatas, but the tone of the statement is set on the same dramatic note. It is always incredibly focused and it's always incredibly powerful. I like Piazzolla for his ability to reach our souls and to speak directly to our hearts.
Well, let's play one of your Piazzolla pieces. This is Le Grand Tango from your first Piazzolla album, Omaggio Piazzolla. And that's my guest, violinist Gidon Kremer, playing Astor Piazzolla's Le Grand Tango from his album Omaggio Piazzolla. I love the swooping high notes you get out of your violin in this piece, and also how it moves from very passionate to a kind of tense mournfulness, and then back again to a heated tango. Is that the challenge for you in navigating the emotional arc of Piazzolla's music?
I don't think Piazzolla is about embellishment. I don't think Piazzolla can be expressed rightly, just gliding on the surface of convenient rhythms. This music can't be, in fact, performed. It has to be lived. And I always can distinguish if someone is flirting with Piazzolla as a convenient item of our commercial industry, or someone really lives the life or the heartbeat of the music of this great composer.
So what does that mean musically, to live it?
To allow oneself to be burned by it. I saw a number of artists in my life that went on stage and were burning, so to say, were not pretending to be big performers or pretending to be big virtuosos, but really were the expression itself. Such artists like Maria Callas or Jacques Brel left a mark in my understanding what a stage presence is. And among them, I can also name an artist like Leonard Bernstein, whom many described as a showman, but I have collaborated with him so much that I know that he, whatever he did, he meant seriously.
You've written three books. Your third book, Between the Worlds, is due out soon. Your second book, you had a beautiful dedication. It was dedicated to all those who are searching for quietness, because that's where the most beautiful music is born. What does that mean to you, this search for quietness?
It means search for meditation. It means listening to your inner voice, and distracted by all the noises which our days surround us. We all suffer from the tendency to promote stars, from the tendency to put stars before the music, from the tendency to be easy listening or easy digesting to the buyers or listeners. We all suffer from it, and I'm trying, as much as I can to follow my own tastes, my own projects, and my own visions. But it's constantly a fight. It's a fight against promoters, fight against labels, and you find collaborators, and I'm very happy to have found a number of them. But here and there, it becomes quite dramatic, this fight.
Well, I'd like to end with some more music, perhaps something that you'd suggest for us, a favorite of yours that we haven't gotten to yet.
It's hard for me to choose something because each recording is very dear to me. But maybe we should visit the site of the beginning of Camerata Baltica, the site of Eight Seasons, which combines music by Vivaldi and Piazzolla.
Very good. Let's listen. And thank you so much, Gidon Kremer, for joining us today.
Thank you for talking to me.
Gidon Kremer's new CD with his Camerata Baltica Orchestra is Happy Birthday. He performs this week in Philadelphia and New York. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Englishman's Daughter, a true story of love and betrayal in World War I by Ben McIntyre, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what went wrong at Arthur Andersen? We talk with Barbara Leigh Toffler, former ethics consultant for the company. The powerhouse accounting firm collapsed last year in the wake of the Enron scandal. Toffler's new book is Final Accounting, Ambition, Greed, and the Fall of Arthur Andersen. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.